You're listening to Upfront. I'm Brian Edwards-Tiekert, and we're going to spend this segment on a lawsuit that sent shockwaves through the worlds of journalism and publishing. In 2016, a jury in Florida awarded the professional wrestler known as Hulk Hogan $140 million in damages against the independent blog umpire Gawker Media, best known for running salacious gossip pieces. On the surface, the lawsuit was about Gawker's decision to publish a sex tape of Hulk Hogan with a friend's wife. But late in the legal proceeding, it became public that Hogan's lawsuit was being financed by a reclusive tech billionaire, Peter Thiel, angry about an entirely different piece of reporting. Our next guest got approached by both sides of that lawsuit, both Thiel and Gawker founder Nick Denton, to tell their side of what happened and of the process that destroyed Gawker Media. Ryan Holiday is a marketing and public relations expert who has written best-selling books about that world and the changing digital media landscape that it interacts with. His new book is Conspiracy: Peter Thiel, Hulk Hogan, Gawker, and the Anatomy of Intrigue. Thanks for talking to us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So I was wondering if you could start by setting the table. What is the piece of reporting in Gawker that catches Peter Thiel's attention?
Well, reporting might be a strange word for it, but in December of 2007, a site called ValleyWag, which would be Gawker Media's Silicon Valley arm, publishes a story that outs Peter Thiel, who was then a relatively unknown technology investor. He was best known for having founded PayPal and then putting the first $500,000 into a company called Facebook, which is not very old in 2007. And this article outs him as gay, and it does it in a, let's say, less than thoughtful way. The headline of the article is "Peter Thiel is totally gay, people." There are no named or attributed sources in the article. And although this article is sort of the initial cause of Thiel's concern, what he really reacts to is a comment that Nick Denton, the founder of Gawker, puts at the bottom of the article. Thiel said to me, "It was never the article, it was always the comment." And this comment basically speculates as to why Thiel was so secretive about his sexuality. And I think, in Thiel's view, puts forth the theory that there's something wrong with Thiel for not wanting to be known as gay.
So this is offensive. It's of dubious journalistic merit, but it's accurate. It's not legally actionable.
Sure. Yes, it is not a crime, although probably frowned upon generally in civilized circles to out someone, at least in 2007. You know, if you'd outed someone in 1968, you might have been able to prove that there were significant damages to their livelihood in doing so. But 2007 to me is this interesting period because, you know, Obama is not yet president. Obama does not even come out in favor of gay marriage until sometime later. Prop 8 passes in California, which bans gay marriage, several months after December 2007. So it's this strange period that I don't think we quite remember well or properly, where being gay is both sort of on the rise in terms of being a positive attribute, but it's still not quite considered what it's considered today. And then we have to throw in there Thiel's sort of desire for secrecy or privacy or whatever it is that makes him decide that he feels that a media outlet should not have written this article, even if they were legally allowed to do so.
Politically speaking, Peter Thiel is kind of an outlier in Silicon Valley. He was the most visible Trump supporter during the most recent presidential campaign in Silicon Valley. He has financed some bizarre libertarian social experiments. How does this public outing by ValleyWag jibe with his worldview?
It's a good question because, in 2007, he's most well known as a libertarian. And so you'd think the libertarian response would be that the government has no business in one's private affairs, whatever they happen to do. But Thiel is somewhat known in Republican circles as well. He identifies as being Christian. I think there is this mystery as to why it bothers him so much. I have come down on what I came across in the researching the book is that it may have been less in it may have been ultimately that he did not want to be defined by his sexuality. He said to me that, you know, I want to be known as the world's best technology investor, not the world's best gay technology investor. And so I think this may have in some ways been a clash of identities. Who gets to define me? Is it this random gossip website that's going to do it in the most sort of salacious, insensitive way? Or is it me, the kind of public but also private individual who gets to determine what people know about me? And then on the other end, you have Nick Denton, the founder of Gawker, who's also gay, the writer of the article, who's also gay, who come down thinking, well, we would never think not to speak of the identity or of the private business of a heterosexual. If someone was having an affair or someone was dating someone, we would never hesitate to talk about their identity of the so-called majority. Why are we acting as if being gay is something that is shameful or should be secret? And so it's this weird clash of visions that ultimately becomes very personal and very human when this article is published.
One of the speculations about why Peter Thiel was so incensed about this public outing of what had been basically an open secret in his social circles was that at the time he was courting investment capital from the Middle East, where doing business with someone who was openly gay might not be possible. Any substance to that?
Well, that's interesting because that is something that the reporter for ValueWag puts forward, and I believe the article hints at it as well. But again, in the sort of typical Gawker style, that's either something that is true or not true, and could be validated with sourcing or attribution. But there's none of that in the article. So So perhaps it would be newsworthy that a technology investor is hiding their sexuality in order to get money out of the Middle East, or is so scared about their sexuality that they're not willing to disclose it to potential investors. That might be news, but it's only news. I think the typical journalistic view is it's only news if you can prove it and verify it. And what Gawker ultimately was, and this is sort of embedded in their slogan, which is that today's gossip is tomorrow's news, or that posting rumors, speculating about things, sort of moves the story along until eventually these theories get validated. And so, again, Thiel finds himself in the middle of this thing that he didn't understand, that he didn't, you know, decide to be a part of. And that's the sort of event that puts these two entities on the sort of fatal crash course that they at the time did not know they were on.
Well, let's talk for a minute about Gawker and what it represented. This type of gossip-based reporting had led them to be the first outlet publishing rumors that there had been sexual assaults perpetuated by Bill Cosby, that Louis C.K. might have a sexual harassment problem, and that the mayor of Toronto might be a crack addict. They got to a lot of stories before anyone else.
Yes. So they were definitely not the first. There's a bit of revisionist history, and I think Gawker has done a pretty magnificent job of creating a sort of a lost cause mythology around themselves. They were definitely not the first by any means to report on the Bill Cosby story. Mm. But they were early on sort of rumors of about Louis C.K., although that was, you know, well after the Thiel piece. But what's so interesting about it, and I think the sort of the duality of Gawker, is that the Louis C.K. story comes out, and it's not for several years later that it's ultimately validated. And at the time, people people didn't take it particularly serious because Gawker had this reputation of both being really right often and really wrong often. And so they sort of saw themselves in some ways as a kind of a clearinghouse for information that other parts of the media system would then sift through and validate. So they were the people who would touch the stories that other outlets wouldn't touch. And or they were the ones who would in some ways maybe go through the slush pile, to use a publishing term, and they would often find these things that other outlets were wrong to have passed on, and then that would certainly burnish Gawker's reputation. And again, not to defend or malign them, look, Gawker published more than 1 million articles in its history. One would hope that we could think of more than 3 or 4 examples of them. If the model of gossip being the best way to get to the truth, one would hope you'd have hundreds or thousands of compelling examples, not, you know, 3 or 4.
But when you write about how Gawker was operating at the time, Nick Denton, the founder, has basically built a structure that makes those kind of screw-ups all but inevitable. He's put counters on page views on every story. He's created an incentive system where, for a while, reporters are getting more pay based on the amount of audience. So the more sensational the things they publish, and they're expected to publish multiple things per day, the more they get paid. Fact value has very little consideration in it.
Well, what was particularly interesting is, as I was researching the sort of history of ValueWag, is that a little less than a year before the Peter Thiel story had come out, ValueWag had sacked its editor, fired its editor, because he had said in an interview that his dream as an editor was to get sued, that he found the fact that they hadn't been sued by any powerful people a sign that they weren't being aggressive enough or they weren't being taken seriously enough. And so ultimately, Nick fires this editor, although he sort of rehires him later on. In a way, this sort of wish to be in conflict with people and to seek out and touch the things that you're not supposed to touch and to not care about the consequences was both was why people liked working at Gawker, why people liked reading Gawker, and it was what made it so powerful and fearsome.
So when Peter Thiel starts to assemble what you describe as a conspiracy to bring the lawsuit that all but destroyed Gawker and personally wiped out Nick Denton, its founder, is he seeing this as personal revenge on the site that outed him, or as serving some kind of larger public interest in taking a scummy gossip site whose publishing philosophy he doesn't agree with off the board?
There's often more clarity to these things in retrospect than I think there was at the time. And what Thiel really did was first he sort of rudely introduced to Gawker. This is his personal experience with a site that is, you know, several years old at this point, and is written about many people more powerful than him and more sort of insensitively than they'd written about with him. And I think he just says, well, maybe I should do something about this. He doesn't know what, he doesn't exactly know why, and he doesn't know what his chances of success are. And so there's this sort of period, you know, Thiel calls this the prehistory and he says that the companies that he's founded have a similar period where there's just sort of a swirling about of ideas. And so, you know, from basically 2007 to 2010, he's just kind of talking to people in Silicon Valley, people in media, people in the law, people who have been written about by Gawker. And he's sort of crafting this theory that, okay, Gawker treats people cruelly. They've done things that are, you know, beyond the pale. They think they're invincible, but there may in fact be some legal recourse against them. And then he ends up assembling a team. He hires Charles Harder, the attorney who now is the personal attorney for Donald Trump. He hires a person identified as Mr. A in the book, who's this sort of mastermind of a lot of what gets happened. But their job is just to figure out what can be done, if anything can be done. And so the clarity of the conspiracy and even this singular lawsuit, which we're talking about, you know, originally the plan was maybe we do hundreds of lawsuits, or, you know, maybe we lobby for legislation. It was a wide open. When you're a billionaire, you have essentially unlimited options. And I think that early period is really him weighing what those are.
So a lot of people would approach litigation saying, what's the strategy that's going to get us the most money? Or what's the strategy that's going to stop the thing we don't want? He's approaching this saying, what's the strategy that will do the most damage?
Or rather, he's saying, if the world would be a better place without Gawker existing, how can I bring that about? And so that is, you know, distinctly different, as you said, than 99.9% of lawsuits. It's either how much money can I make, or how can I get some symbolic form of justice? How can I get an apology? What Thiel is looking to do, as he said to me, was essentially destroy this company. He said he was looking for a knockout blow. And so, yes, the lawsuit, you know, he's not looking for, you know, petty libel or defamation claims. You know, he's not looking for slaps on the wrist. He's looking for a bankruptcy inducing event of some kind. And whether he does that with 50 lawsuits or one, you know, stupefyingly bold lawsuit, he's kind of indifferent to that.
So how do he and his attorney, Charles Harder, land on the strategy of using Hulk Hogan as a straw plaintiff in a lawsuit that they are secretly, that Thiel is secretly financing?
In a way, it's almost as if Hogan fell in their lap. So in 2000, we could say that probably around April 2011, this conspiracy begins in earnest. The sort of first people are brought on as retainer. They begin to look for various cases, but they're mostly looking backwards, right? They're looking at Gawker's archives. Who has Gawker written about? You know, who's tried to sue Gawker, who is in the middle of suing Gawker? And it's not until over a year later, in October of 2012, that Gawker runs the, and this was known at the time, a surreptitiously recorded sex tape of Terry Bollea, aka Hulk Hogan, having sex with the wife of his best friend, a man named, legally named, Bubba the Love Sponge. So Gawker runs this story. It's a story that it run and plays 141 seconds of the tape. And they did this despite a sort of a slow drumbeat of news leaking out about the tape, that it had been recorded without Hulk's, that Hogan claimed it had been recorded without his consent, that it, that he was not aware that it was being recorded, that that he planned to sue whoever, any outlet that published it. And Gawker ends up pulling the trigger on October 4th, 2012. And this story is immediately so sensational that it comes to the attention of Charles Harder and Peter Thiel, and it becomes their first serious plaintiff against Gawker.
So what's their proposition to Terry Bollea, a.k.a. Hulk Hogan?
You know, one of the funniest things I heard from Thiel is Thiel said that Terry Bollea was only a single-digit millionaire and therefore could have never afforded to fight a war with people who buy ink by the barrel, or really any deep-pocketed media company. You know, at this point, Gawker is worth between $200 and $300 million. They have revenues of $40 to $50 million a year. Hulk Hogan, as famous as he is, has a net worth of, you know, $3 or $4 million at this time. Is in no way in a position to spend what ultimately amounted to $10 to $20 million in legal fees. And so their proposition to him is, you have said you plan to sue any outlet that runs this tape. Well, if you decide to sue Gawker, we would be willing to not only provide legal funding, but provide this team behind you to help you in that pursuit. And so this is really an offer that Hogan not only can't decline, kind of can't even think too much about, right? He is getting, if you think about the offer, it sounds insane. Hey, an unknown businessman is reaching out to you through an attorney saying, I'm not going to tell you who I am, but I'm willing to fund this lawsuit as far as you're willing to take it. That's the kind of thing, you know, you would typically want to investigate, but Hogan needs to get this tape off the internet and he can't afford to do it himself. And so he agrees to these somewhat unusual terms for you know, largely out of desperation.
Right. And the quid pro quo from the outside seemed to be that the legal strategy did not always maximize the potential value for Hulk Hogan. Like, they carefully calibrated the causes of action in the lawsuit so as not to trigger Gawker's insurance. And the insurance company is a deeper pocketed entity to go after than the Gawker Media Company itself. If you wanted to be assured of a large and timely payment, you'd rather have them involved with the case.
It's a somewhat complicated set of legal maneuvering. So on the one hand, Hogan is in charge of the case. Hogan can decide to settle at any time. You can decide to drop the case at any time. So it's this sort of loose alliance, right? Ultimately, they decide that they have a very good chance of winning a very large verdict. And so they end up, Charles Harder reaches out to Gawker's insurance company, which was in most cases probably not going to be on the hook for this case, but as a